Theatre with me, Lucy Parsons. Welcome to the final episode in this week-long series all about academic coaching. In today's episode, we've got an interview with Carolyn Johannesson, who is one of the academic coaches on my team. Previously this week, we've had episodes about what academic coaching actually is, we've compared tutoring to academic coaching, and we've had interviews with two other academic coaches, Helen Chaplin and Kirti Permeser. And if you'd like to catch up on those episodes, please go to the page on my website at lifemoreextraordinary.com/academic-coaching. And on that page, you can also download our brochure, which gives you everything you need to know about academic coaching to help you decide if you'd like to work with us in this way. Okay, let's get on with today's episode with Carolyn. Welcome to the School Success Formula, Carolyn Johannesson.
Thank you, Lucy. It's very nice to be here.
Oh, yeah, it's great to have you here. And you've been working with me for a year now, haven't you? And working with all sorts of different people. And it's been a really fantastic year. So it's high time I introduced you to all the people in my kind of community. So could you start us off, Carolyn, by telling us a little bit about your history and what brought you to academic coaching?
Oh gosh, yes. Seems like a good place to start. Quite a checkered history actually, Lucy. I'd always loved school and anything to do with school. I went to a very ordinary comprehensive school in the north of England and on to sixth form college, university. At that time, and certainly as a young child, I'd always intended to go into teaching. But whilst I was at university, I had the opportunity to do campus radio and was a journalist, a reporter on the campus radio. And I decided that journalism sounded a much more exciting opportunity than teaching at that stage. And I qualified as a journalist and then got into marketing, which was one of my subjects at university. And just got, you know, you get into a career, you have a house, you have a mortgage, and the years went by and it's very difficult to step off that kind of treadmill. We came down south in the 90s and I was still in marketing, but I'd switched to public sector marketing. And I found myself working for a large unitary authority, and one of my jobs was to support schools in the marketing of themselves. And that was when the little seeds started to sow again, you know, oh, here I am, I'm finding myself in education. I'd had my children by this time and I was starting to feel like if I'm ever going to teach, I need to find an opportunity to jump out of this corporate world into education. And as luck would have it, there was a major restructure going on in the council, and I decided, partly because I was having a really tough time commuting 90 minutes each way to my job, but I wanted to jump off and I would just take some time to think about how I could get into teaching. So that's what I did, and I started volunteering at my son's school and found myself in a science lab and listening to children read and doing some French conversation work. And his teacher said to me, "You know what, Carolyn, you need to be in the classroom," she said. Go and visit the university up the road, which is Southampton. I'm sure I read somewhere they're still taking applicants for their PGCE course. And so I thought, gosh, here's someone else telling me that would be a good fit. So, you know, within a couple of weeks of starting this volunteering in the classroom, I'm there having an interview for the PGCE, primary teaching specialism in French, and was offered a place immediately and started that September. And so that was the start of my second career, if you like, in teaching. And you know, it's really strange because I'm now at that school where I volunteered. I've come full circle and I'm teaching French in that school. And the lady who's made that suggestion to me is a very, very close colleague that I do quite a lot of collaborative work with. So it's strange how things work out. But in terms of being involved with you, it was through my son. he's now 17, so maybe 2-3 years ago he was doing his GCSE years, and things were steady but not fantastic, and he didn't have a lot of confidence in the way he was learning and his ability to answer questions. And I'm not 100% sure how I found your website or your Facebook page, but thankfully I did. And we enrolled. I have to say it was probably me that was doing the course and adapting it for him and being the middleman to him, because he's not too receptive about things like this. But what he is receptive to are the ideas that have come out of your course and your program. And so I was able to be that middleman or be that coach for him. And then I saw your advert, your promotion for people to join your team. And I actually said to myself, gosh, well, I'm doing that already with Dan. Why not approach Lucy and see whether I can join her team? So I did, and I did my little video for you, and we had a chat. And that was, like you say, over a year ago now. So yeah, that's how it came. Like, quite a circuitous route, quite a different route, I think. But I think it's one of the best things that has happened in my career. To find myself doing the coaching with you. Yeah.
What, why is that, Carolyn?
Well, I think, you know, it's difficult. Sometimes you're in a career or a job, and it's what you do, and it just becomes humdrum, and it becomes a means to an end. And this felt very different. It feels like it's the place I was meant to be. It feels like I can make a real difference with young people, and that feels good. Not in a sort of cheesy way, but it feels really good, because there are young people out there that genuinely struggle in the environment they find themselves in, and to help them unlock some of those struggles and find ways forward, it can only be good, can't it? So yeah, I'm thoroughly enjoying being part of your team and helping the young people that I've had the pleasure of working with.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And yeah, I remember you joining the Extraordinaries Club, and you saying, I think you sent me an email when you joined. It's like, I'm not sure if I've got Dan on board, but I'm joining. And you kept sending me these little messages through the year saying, oh, I think it's great. I think it's wonderful. And I'm passing it all on to him and all this kind of thing. And it was lovely hearing all of that. And then I remember you emailing me when I put out that advert for people to join the team as academic coaches. And you were like, but could I do it? Could I really do it? And we had a chat, didn't we, one Friday morning. And I was like, yes, you can do it. And yeah, so we had a proper interview. And yeah, it's been fantastic. And, you know, it's been wonderful. You know, I think what you say, I think the difference you can make for young people is quite profound in their lives, isn't it? That, you know, you can reveal to them truly what they're capable of if you strip away all these things that are getting in the way. And yeah, it makes a massive difference.
The most incredible thing to me actually is just the simplicity of it all. Maybe we'll talk a bit about my own schooling in a bit, but you know, none of that kind of simple hints and tips and suggestions existed when I was in Dan's shoes and doing my GCSEs or O levels as they were then. And I think had something like this been in place, it's like little lights going on, you know, it's just so simple and straightforward. And I suppose some youngsters might think, oh, that's straightforward. What, I need to even listen to that. That's taken as read. But it might well be. But if, you know, if you're not following those disciplines and you're not believing those simplicities, you're never going to make the strides forward that you can. And it's simple, straightforward, and exciting.
It was the same really when I was at school. I think probably even 10 years ago almost, you know, there was this kind of belief in society that you were either clever and academic and you did well, or you weren't. And you know, you kind of sank or swam, really, didn't you?
Yes.
And I think there's been such huge leaps forward with kind of positive psychology and all that kind of thing. And, you know, particularly this idea of growth mindset, that you can improve if you put the work in, if you put the right kind of work in. And getting young people to believe that is just like the biggest battle, isn't it?
It is. It really is. Yeah. And I think all the things that they are distracted with, rely upon instant gratification. You know, they want it, they want the best one, they want the newest one, and they want it now. And because of that backdrop, the idea of working hard, striving towards something, taking the knocks, being prepared to get yourself up again, being resilient, can be eroded sometimes and forgotten just how important it is to make mistakes and to jump those challenges and to, you know, to face failure and to move forward, because everything supposedly seems all rosy outside, but you know, we know that it's not. And those, to instill those beliefs in young people is really important.
Definitely. I think that's a natural point to ask you about your own biggest struggle in your education and how you overcame it.
Yeah, gosh, that was a really interesting question. I kind of got two that extremes of my education, if you like. Well, the first one, I suppose it was very challenging to me being at secondary school. It was an ordinary comprehensive school. It was the former grammar school, so it was steeped in that tradition, but it's recently turned into comprehensive. And I had the unfortunate situation of having my dad as head of modern foreign languages there, which, you know, was okay, but it led to a couple of things. It led to a bit of bullying and a bit of, you know, you're only getting those marks because your dad's here and that kind of thing. I just wanted to keep my head down, do well, work hard, and I'd always been a hard worker at school. School had never fazed me, but the challenge came from the massive expectation that was placed upon me. So partly by myself, I suppose, but partly by dad, the staff, you know, oh, you're John's daughter, you know, you can't possibly go wrong, it must all be brilliant. And I had to sort of dig deep and work really hard for my own success. And unfortunately, I think in many ways, I didn't put a foot wrong throughout the whole 5 years. And end of term exams, you know, everything was as good as it could have been. But thinking about the actual pinnacle of being there, the O levels, I didn't reach the potential that I should have and maybe could have, and it's always a source of regret to me. And it probably happened because I didn't have the support in place, because there was this expectation that actually she's okay, she's working hard, it'll be fine. And I still remember the day walking in, getting my O-level results. And in those days, they were all pinned on the wall and you had to line your name up with the grades and read the subject down across like that. Terrible, terrible thing.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a single A grade there. I got 5 B's and 3 C's and I was so distraught and so disappointed. So, you know, that was a real challenge to sort of pick myself up from that and then enrol at sixth form and, you know, go on to my A levels, and which were fine, went to university, all of that happened. But I still remember it taints my 5 years at secondary school, but I wanted to do so well. But I think what it was more about wanting to do well for other people. And I don't think I necessarily had that inside me that said, I want to do well for me. Because people kept saying to me, oh, you'll be fine, I've every confidence in you, it's fine, it's fine. And perhaps, you know, inside, I didn't feel that it was fine.
You did or you didn't?
I didn't feel it was fine, no. Looking back, I think, you know, I possibly needed more support, more practical encouragement, more help in being able to reach those A grades.
Do you think you were conscious of that at the time? Do you think, you know, if people around you weren't saying, oh, you're fine, do you think you would have reached out for support, or do you think you were unaware that you needed that support?
Yeah, I think I was unaware, because on the face of it, everything was perfect. You know, all my coursework, all my schoolwork was always tip top. I think I just crumbled in the exam situation. I didn't know how to handle exams. And, you know, these exams were like, I did 8 O-levels, so it wasn't like the number of O-levels GCSEs they do today. There was, you know, probably just one or maybe two papers for each subject. It wasn't the onerous task that it's painted out to be today. I don't think I was prepared for it. I don't think anyone actually prepared me for it. Not just me, the whole cohort. But others that perhaps were a bit gung-ho about it and went into it a little bit more relaxed, possibly did better. I don't know, it's the old exam technique thing of its day, but that's, I felt, you know.
Yeah, how did you get over that then? You know, you said you picked yourself up, but, you know, what did that really look like, you know, when you got to sixth form?
When I got to sixth form, I mean, obviously, you know, like with any sixth former, they're choosing the subjects they love to do. So I did French, I did economics as a new subject, and then English literature, and had some great tuition there, great teachers, lecturers. I just, again, got my head down, you know. You could find me in the library. if anyone wanted to find me, I'd be in the library. And things were different, I think. There was no uniform. Dad wasn't there. It was a sixth form college. You were grown up a touch. And it was a bit more exciting. And I think maybe the different environment, you know, helped me get things right. But, you know, I'm not painting my education. I certainly don't believe that I was a failure, but I've just got this little niggle that it never turned out quite at the level that it could have or maybe should have.
So you hinted that there was another struggle?
This one was a much more sort of positive struggle in a way. And this was when I was at university. So I enrolled at Lancaster University, and I was on a 4-year course. It was French with marketing, so it was a joint honours degree. And the third year was going to be a year abroad. So I was never, I'm not a naturally garrulous type of loud, overconfident person by any stretch of the imagination. And I was holding this idea of having the year abroad as it was going to be quite a challenge to me. I was tentatively excited about it, but I was equally concerned about it. And I thought, you know, I'm going to imagine, what do I want to be, and how do I want things to be when I come back from France? Let's start with that point. So I knew I wanted to be completely fluent. I wanted to have really have had a fantastic year, gained in confidence, met new people, and come back to university ready to just finish that degree in a very positive way. So interestingly, when we were all organizing this year abroad, many of my friends were wanting to go to places together. So they, you know, there was different opportunities, and a lot of them ended up in Paris together. And a lot of them ended up in Lille at the university studying and doing some language work together. And so I thought, I hadn't really intended this to be Lancaster removed to France. I want something a bit different. So I put the lecturer under quite some pressure. I said, I want to go somewhere on my own. I want to be as far away from compatriots as possible. And I want to really soak myself into the community. So, but all the time my tummy was churning, so is this really you saying this? Are you really saying this? Do you really want this? And I was offered the most amazing opportunity to go and live down on the French-Swiss border near a town called Besançon on the eastern border. And I got the job, and I was working in the telecoms industry as a translator, interpreter, and export assistant. I was earning money. There was a flat with the job. I had a little studio flat above a cheese shop in the high street. And I thought, this is just incredible. And, you know, I actually manufactured that situation myself. You know, I thought, you've been because you want to reinvent yourself as confident, fluent, you know, cosmopolitan, outward facing person, you've chosen this route. And now, don't get it wrong, you know, go for it. And I had the most amazing year. And, you know, all my friends were terribly envious about, you know, the places I visited, the jobs I had to do, the opportunities I had, the visits, the people I met. I'm still in touch with people friends I met there. And I'm so proud of myself, because that could have been, you know, almost a breaker in that year, if I'd starting the year feeling with that level of trepidation that I had. When I came back, I look back at what I do, and I still look back at what I do. And I think there's lessons for everyone around stepping out of your comfort zone, being prepared to understand what your comfort zone is, and taking that risk now and again. You know, there are so many opportunities out there for youngsters to do that. And I would say, do it, because you just never know how it's going to turn out.
No, I think that's wonderful. Just before we move on, how do you think that changed how you saw yourself, having done that, kind of when you came back, and what you were able to do in life as a result of having had that experience?
Well, I think, you know, it made me getting back to university was actually quite surprisingly difficult, having had that year out, earning money, doing all of that stuff. And then knowing you had to come back to university, it's like, oh gosh, I'm hemmed in again, and you know, I've got to get through this next stage to be able to fly again. So that fourth year was quite tough, but it goes incredibly quickly, doesn't it? But I just think, as a person, you know, to have that in your armory of things that you've done when you graduate, and when you start job hunting and thinking about where you want to go in life. It's a great tick in the box to show that you've actually lived in a foreign country and been successful and you've survived it.
I think that's incredible. I honestly don't think that I could do that. I've been a proper homebody my whole life. I get homesick, and that's why I ended up living in the village where I grew up. So I am absolutely in awe that you did that. I think that's amazing.
Thing your turn may come in the future, Lucy. Never say never.
I don't know. Okay, so next question. The experience you've had as a teacher, I think you work a little bit as a tutor as well. How does that kind of inform what you do as an academic coach?
The experience I've had as a teacher? As a teacher? Well, I think, you know...
Do you think it's more as a parent, maybe?
I read it as parent. I'm thinking teacher, parent. That's me, isn't it? I'm a teacher, I'm a parent. And I think, in a way, I bring that sort of mix into the coaching, because I can, as a parent, I can have empathy with the parents of the person being coached, which I think can be as important as dealing with the young person themselves, because I've been that parent, particularly since being in teaching, where, you know, I know how to find the exam boards, I know what's in the curriculum, I know, if I don't know something, I can find it. And my boys have found that incredibly frustrating at times, because they said, well, Mom, what are you talking about AQA for? You're not supposed to know about AQA. I said, ha-ha, well, I do know about the exam board, so I do know what's expected. So I think, you know, knowledge of education and the way it works is helpful, obviously, to know what those young people are being asked to do. And where to find information. But I think it's more as a parent that sits better for me with the coaching, because my boys are now 17 and 23. So they've been through all of those formative stages of education, the exam years. They've also been through things like bullying, mental health struggles, the intensity of it all, meltdowns. you know, they're boys as well, so they've shown those boy type traits of being lazy, of being disorganized, unfocused, tired. You know, I've had a real picture of all of those challenges that boys can have, and each time I've been able to work, since knowing you, work with your program to sort of head some of those off and to find solutions. But generally, just be a mom and take those challenges on as they come, really. And the number of mums that I've met of boys who say exactly the same thing, I've been able to sort of develop lines of communication and empathy with those mums. And we share ideas all the time in my own friendship group about, you know, this worked, that worked, have you tried this, did you say that, why didn't you say the other? And I think mums of boys, it's tricky. It's really tricky because they're fighting for their, you know, their masculinity, their place in life, their profile. And to you as a mum, they're always going to be your little boy. And, you know, I will never apologise for wading in and trying to help. But I always want to make sure I'm helping in the right way. And sometimes, you know, it's complicated. And I recognise that. And I've had conversations like that with parents of client parents. Yeah, it's, you're caught in, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't sometimes with boys. It's an interesting journey.
Yeah, and well, I think with girls as well, but it's often a slightly different story and a slightly different mix of issues with girls, isn't it? I think what you say about being able to empathise with the parents, you know, they wouldn't come to us if they weren't, you know, there's kind of two groups, but the biggest group is people where they can see it all unwinding and it all going wrong and they're like, help, you know. I've come to the end of the road of what we can do as a family without some, you know, external input in this. And so really being able to empathise with that, you know, that I think a lot of parents almost feel like they're failing, don't they? And that's just such a horrible place to be, because you, as a parent, all you ever want to do is the very best by your child. But, you know, having somebody like you be that kind of objective person and, you know, develop a rapport and a different relationship with a child that can, you know, help them. It takes the emotion out of the situation.
It does. Doesn't it? Yeah. It's a very fine line as a parent trying to... also, I find that the fine line is as much about doing something for a child as facilitating them being able to do it for themselves.
Yes.
And I've had to learn over the years that, you know, however much you might want to just, they call it helicopter parent, I don't know, zoom in, do something and zoom
hover back over them, waiting for them to need you.
It's giving them the tools for them to thrive and being
on their own.
on their own and being there to help support if things go wrong. And it's a fine, it's like being on a tightrope, it's a fine line.
Very fine line, definitely. Thank you, Carolyn, that was really interesting. So what do you love about academic coaching, and have you got any examples of young people, no names, of like how you've helped people make breakthroughs?
Well, what I love about it, it sounds cliched and cheesy, and I don't want it to sound that, but it for me, it's about those light bulb moments, those feelings that you're making a difference, and knowing that those conversations that you're having with that young person are moving them forward and helping them unlock their potential. For me, that's what it's all about. I suppose thinking about the clients that I've had, many of them, nearly all of them have been boys, and that's possibly because, you know, of my own history having boys.
It's also because of the people that come to us.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, there have been a couple of girls, and quickly, just to say about them, they have been incredibly motivated and passionate about what they're doing. And it's been an absolute delight to work with the girls on very specific areas of what they wanted to do. I think one of them was about managing their time and ability to be distracted and bring them back on focus. But the boys, mainly it's about getting them organized to get through a school day and to know at any one point what they need to do when, in terms of deadlines, time management, revision planning, all of that stuff. Some of them, and Dan has been as bad. This has been a big challenge for him, actually. He tends to want to carry information in his head. He will not commit things to paper. And I don't know whether that's because once it's on paper, there's a bit more sort of importance attached to it. He maintains he can keep things in his head, but I think it's been proved over time that's not necessarily a good idea. But one boy in particular, who this boy actually hadn't really, sounded to me like he hadn't had an awful lot of positive comments about his time at school ever. And he wasn't getting any feeling at all from home or from school that things were positive. And he just kind of, it felt like he'd just withdrawn from the process, and it was a process that was being done to him, and he wasn't involved in his schooling, his education at all. I worked with him over several months, trying to chip away at this feeling of something being done to me, until we got to a point where he'd had a really good school report for the first time ever. And not only that, teachers were actually saying things to him, reporting verbal praise, giving him praise verbally, so that he knew at the moment he'd done something right, that he was doing it right, and he was doing it well, and he was achieving. And that made such a difference to his outlook at school and his ability to stay focused and to keep going with his revision. I can't put my finger on what it was I said particularly, but I think it was just having that independent person who is like having a critical friend, I suppose. I'm not a teacher, I'm not a parent, I've got no axe to grind, but I do have some interesting things to say, which you might find useful, and if you want to feed back to me, we can start this dialogue of understanding where you are with your learning, where you'd like to be with your learning, and how we can work together to get there. And that's the interesting dynamic all the time, because personality comes into it, doesn't it? Of course it does.
Definitely.
I've had some of the most amazing conversations across the Zoom screen with these incredible young people that I find myself talking to. And also understanding just what a context they're working within. It's a complicated world out there for them, both in terms of their education, but also, the social media side of things, just the pressure to achieve, not only at school, but in sport, in drama, in whatever it is they're doing.
And how they look, and
There doesn't seem to be an awful lot of downtime for them in terms of just letting them be themselves. And that's, that's really important.
Definitely. Thank you for sharing that. I remember you working with that particular young man, and he did come from a very, very low place, and that report he got was just amazing. That will stay with him, how he changed to achieve that. Yeah, definitely. Okay, let's have some quick fire questions to finish, Carolyn. So Which book has had the biggest impact on your life?
Oh, a book. For me, it has to be memorable. It has to draw lessons. It has to be one I want to go back to. And it has to sort of operate on different levels. So I kind of thought, what book can I share with Lucy that answers all of those things? And I have to go back to my A-level French class, and it's Le Petit Prince, The Little Prince, by Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. And it was one of my A-level texts. It's a very short book, very, very childlike book, beautifully illustrated. So you can imagine my A-level group, you're giving us a child's book for A-level French, sir? What's that all about? Very, on the face of it, it's a very simple story, but as you read it, and the symbolism is so incredibly deep and meaningful and complicated. You can read it at whatever level you want, and you find new things from it. And it's one I always go back to. I read it in English. It's particularly beautiful in French. That is one of my all-time favourite books.
Thank you. I don't think I've ever read that one. So
do you not?
I'll have to get it.
You should give it a try.
Yeah. Okay, next question. Who was your favourite teacher and why?
Okay, two favourite teachers, very quickly. Mrs Campbell, year three, then I had her again in year six. Very strong disciplinarian, very old school mom type. Helped me develop a work ethic towards my schoolwork. She was very strict, but very fair. She gave me opportunity to have leadership by putting me in charge of running the tuck shop. instilled in us, I think, a healthy sense of competition in the class. It was okay to win, but we also learned how to lose, and to lose with grace. So lots of lessons from her. And she was the teacher that first taught me French. So she's very important. And that's where my love of French first started, in a school context. Second teacher, sixth form college, English literature, Mr. Lancaster. Such passion for his subject. Spellbinding, mesmeric lessons, introduced me to the poems of Seamus Heaney, which I still love. Rich and beautiful language, such an interesting guy teaching us that. So, and he was also so very kind. I missed my English literature grade by one level. And in the time between getting my results at college and walking home, he had rung home to see that I was all right. He was so kind. I was all right. It all turned out. I got into university without that extra grade, but I remember him. He's no longer with us now, and it's very sad, but he was a lovely, lovely teacher.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you. What about your favourite holiday destination?
Oh, right. This one didn't take much thinking about. I am a city break kind of girl. European cities. I've been to a number of European cities, but the one that I have most affinity and love for is my husband's birthplace, which is Oslo. Something there for everyone. Many, many holidays spent there. The fjord, obviously, on the harbour side. The architecture is fantastic. The Royal Palace, parks and gardens, shops, seafood restaurants. Even on a rainy day, we get on a tram and we just ride around Oslo for the day, get on the tram up and down. We go up to the ski jump. In Oslo, there's a ski jump, Holmenkollen, which sits over the city, and the view from up there is fantastic. So that's a very favourite place. We go to the Edvard Munch Museum,
okay,
and to see the paintings. We go to the Viking ships, and yeah, we just love Oslo. So that would be my favourite destination.
Fantastic! I've never been there. When COVID's over, I'll have to go. And next one, favourite takeaway or food?
Oh well, my favourite takeaway. I think it has to be. If anyone has asked me 5 years ago that this was the answer I would give you, I would probably say no, never. I would never say that. But over the last few years, I've learned to love curries. I don't go too hot with curries, but I do like a nice chicken, say, passanda or chicken tikka. with all the dips and salads and poppadoms and all of that. So a good takeaway curry and a nice cool glass of beer as well. That does sound very well on a hot day.
I do love a curry as well. And what's your most used app on your phone, would you say?
I use Facebook a lot to keep in touch with family and friends over the whole world, really. I also use WhatsApp for group talks. I manage the local food bank, and we've got a WhatsApp group, so that's always on my phone, and also with teachers from school. My son loves to talk to me through Instagram, so that's another one. But one of my favourites is Manchester United.
There's an app, is
Manchester that? United app.
Okay, wow.
Watch with all everything football.
Amazing, brilliant. Well, gosh, you're full of surprises for me today, Carolyn.
I thought that might surprise you.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a really wonderful conversation. So I'd love to say to anybody listening, if you'd love Carolyn to be your academic coach, please do get in touch. The first step is to go to lifemoreextraordinary.com/academic-coaching, and there you can download our academic coaching brochure, and that will tell you everything you need to know about it. And from there you can book a call with us to discuss taking it further. So if you'd like to work with Carolyn or any of the other coaches that we've had on the podcast this week, then please go to lifemoreextraordinary.com/academic-coaching. Okay, thank you so much for listening, and particularly if you've been listening to all the episodes this week, I hope you've enjoyed them. Have a wonderful day and goodbye.